We're actually taping this for television. And what we're going to be doing is putting out before Christmas, long before Christmas, a two-tape set combining what we did in Phoenix, Arizona, with what is going to be occurring here. And there is an interesting connection, and that's why I'm wearing the Thunderbird Phoenix tonight. Everybody thinks it's because I moved to New Mexico. Nah. It's because it's fitting. It's an appropriate symbol. This is going to be an evening of symbols. It turns out that the puzzle we have been working so hard to figure out, to unravel, is filled with archetypal symbols. And the symbols extend from some of the visual things you're going to see tonight to some of the audio things that you're going to hear, courtesy of a new collaborator in our far-flung team. I'm extremely pleased that sitting beside me here on the dais is David John Oates. I have been a fan of David, although he didn't know it, for some time, because when I first ran into the concept of reverse speech, which is a remarkably interesting concept, fascinatingly interesting concept, it had nothing to do with David. It had to do with a very powerful staff person at one of the major Senate committees in Washington, D.C., who at a private meeting revealed this technology to us, 10 years ago, almost 10 years ago, 1988, and told us, this group of people that were part of this small briefing, that in fact it was in standard use as a tool of the committee. Now imagine if, regardless of polygraph and sodium pentothal and all those technologies, you had a means which even had a better than 50-50 chance of telling you what a witness under oath really was thinking when he or she testified. The question, of course, is if you had such an extraordinarily powerful tool, would you tell the world you had it? Would you reveal it? Would you let just us guys know? And the answer, of course, is of course not. You're silly. You certainly wouldn't want your witnesses to know, because then they would come armed with some kind of defense mechanism. And apparently, from my conversations with David, there are some defenses, again, not perfect, but there are some defenses which can be raised against this window, this insight into the subconscious. And we're seeing those in operation, and we'll describe what we mean by that a little later in the evening. The second hit I had on the validity of this remarkable tool was from one of the key intelligence agencies in Washington, because within a few days of finding out that a Senate committee was using this, remember, this is back in 1988, I found that one of the major branches of the intelligence community also for years has been quietly using this. So when I first heard David on ART, and then I read after the NASA reversals the incredible acrimony and controversy and hand-wringing and arm-waving that occurred on the Enterprise website in the conference room. You know, my God, has he lost his mind? You know, we're talking about me, you know. I was a little perplexed, because it's obvious that these people, you know, had not gotten the word that this is a tool that is in standard use by the same folks that in part don't want us to know what's going on. Surprise, surprise. The astonishing thing is that David is among us, has been aggressively pursuing, in a very visible public fashion, this set of discoveries. And I call it a technology because it comes with certain technological things. And there's been a couple of breakthroughs. Apparently now there is a computer program which will allow David to actually zero in on the backwards parts of the phoneme stream that are coherent. And that's remarkable for two reasons. One is it will cut down the time to go to the part of the tape where the good stuff is. And two, if a machine, which of course is not listening to anything, it's simply looking at patterns, if a pattern recognizer algorithm can in fact be taught, programmed to find the key reversals, it goes a long way to proving the objectivity, the real-world scientific objectivity of the whole field. So that's a really important breakthrough, and I'm sure when David comes up here, he will regale you with some further information on that. Where our paths crossed was when our mutual good friend Art Bell, and you know, in this town, which is kind of like Hollywood by metonymy, you know, Hollywood is that-a-way. In this town, people throw around, you know, the word friend a lot. And I am very pleased to say that Art Bell and I are really friends, because he is doing something independent and standing his ground and going against the grain many times when it would be much easier to do something different. And I appreciate him for that, and I think, if I get to the point faster, he appreciates me for some of the things that we're doing. You know, I just love to turn that knife on. Make him sweat. And it was Art who, independent, had the bright idea to take that very remarkable interview by NASA, the two representatives, Donna Savage and Ray Villard, several months ago, and submit the tape to David to analyze. And as David will tell you, looking at what NASA was doing was perhaps the farthest thing from his mind. He still is not quite sure why he's up here tonight. It's like this force bigger than both of us has brought his investigation and ours together and has produced, as you'll hear. Anyway, my plan tonight is that we're going to be very, very informal. And the reason is that we're not ready to do this.
No kidding.
You know, I'm being honest, you know. But we can cover the not being ready by being very informal. We haven't got all the frames around various things, and this is a work in progress. So what you're seeing tonight is kind of a first blush of what we've got at this juncture, at this data point. And what we will do, I think the local MUFON people down in Orange County have invited me, I ran into one of the representatives a few minutes ago, for October to do a presentation here in Southern California. And by that time, David and I will be much more ready, and we'll have frames around things, and we'll have more stuff. So if anybody is intrigued with what they're going to see in here tonight, then we can follow up. I have been killing time. This is not a digression. I've been killing time. Why don't you come up here, all right? This is one of our stalwart Enterprise volunteers, supporters, collaborators, colleagues. He has just placed a phone call to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory to give us some news. As you know, tonight we planned this coincident with the rocket firing, the retro rocket burn of Mars Surveyor into orbit, and what I've tasked Skip to do is to call over and find out whether we made it.
I didn't have much time to talk to them. They said the press conference is going on right at the present time, and that Mars Orbiter is in fact around Mars right now.
Thank you. This is the background of why we're here. As you now have heard, there is a second NASA spacecraft, as of a few minutes ago, successfully placed in orbit around Mars to companion with the spacecraft several months ago that was placed successfully on the surface of Mars. This spacecraft, Mars Surveyor, is the replacement for the missing Mars Observer. And as such, it carries, in terms of our investigation, a really important responsibility, because it is the spacecraft which, bar none, if I can have the slide projector on, can someone gently just turn on the slide projector? That's it. Okay. And the lights down, please. It is the mission which, if all goes well, and I mean that in the largest possible sense, as you'll hear, finally will have the technological capability of answering the question, is this, in fact, a real three-dimensional artificial construct by someone on Mars? Now, as you know, Mars Observer disappeared because there was an accident. NASA claimed that 2 days out from reaching Mars orbit, the spacecraft, which would have photographed this region at great protest, to a resolution of approximately 1 meter per pixel, which means it could spot a coffee table from orbit, disappeared. And after a tremendous amount of political fuss including appearances by myself and others on shows like Good Morning America, where we basically tried to hold the agency's feet to the fire and point out that for the first time in over 30 years, this is 1993, they were not planning to re-photograph Mars on live television, that they would withhold, embargo, you know, put in a drawer somewhere the pictures for up to a year. Well, we felt we had the political upper hand in that the agency would be forced, when the spacecraft arrived, to basically give us live data. And it didn't happen, because literally within minutes of a debate that I had on Good Morning America with the Mars Observer Program scientist from NASA headquarters, Bevan French, as Good Morning America ended precisely at 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning in New York, a telephone call, this is in the summer of 93, was placed by Bob McMillan just up the street here at JPL to Lee Siegel, who was the science guy over at AP, the Associated Press. And McMillan informed Mr. Siegel, exactly as GMA ended, that they had lost Mars Observer 14 hours before, and for some reason just hadn't gotten around to telling anybody, including the Mars Observer Program scientist, who we had debated in terms of the live TV and rephotographed Sidonia issue. Well, needless to say, we were a tad skeptical of this. And if you look at the latest edition of Monuments of Mars, the flagship of our investigation, you will see a detailed chronology in one of the epilogues, I forget which one now, it's gone through so many iterations, where we were able to get hold of original JPL releases and memos and make a fairly good case, I believe, that in fact the spacecraft never disappeared. This was a cover story. This was something they just told us so the heat would go off the mission and they could do with that mission whatever they wanted without public grilling or visibility. Now, that was a speculation, although I must say that subsequent to the press conference that we held 2 days later on August 22nd, which was the day they were supposed to go into orbit, I did get back in New Jersey 4 separate phone calls from confidants or friends or close colleagues of 4 separate JPL engineers, each one not knowing that the other had called, all 4 affirming that in fact the Mars Observer mission had been taken stealth, that it was not gone, it had not disappeared, it was a story to make us shut up. But you can't get people who are afraid, for a whole series of reasons, to go on 2020. So we were never able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the allegation. It would have been interesting if we could have used those tapes and given them to David. In fact, in retrospect, in his copious spare time, well, we're discussing how to handle the logistics of this, but we have this remarkable new tool, because that was pre-Bell show, before NASA people learned to read. They're reading so well these days. Anyway, so why are we here tonight? We're here tonight because in the shock and wake of the disappearance of Mars Observer, the agency put in place another mission, carrying approximately half of the instrument complement of the original, Mars Observer. It is that mission, Mars Surveyor, which a few minutes ago successfully entered Martian orbit for the first time in some 20 years. And of course, as one might expect, an awful lot of people, us included, are pinning their hopes on a resolution of this mystery with a mission. Well, one of the reasons that we are here tonight is to provide evidence that in fact the fix is in, that we have no more chance of getting live, unvarnished, uncensored, real, non-altered images confirming the presence of the structures at Sidonia than pigs have of flying to the moon. And the proof of that is the substance of what we're going to present this evening. Because what we're going to present is evidence that, in terms of the ongoing missions, NASA is already busily, feverishly, altering the data from the current mission, Mars Pathfinder, and what's more, blatantly lying to the American people and to the world about its real agenda. And far from simply being an allegation, the breakthrough tonight to which you will witness is that two separate lines of investigation, the imagery analysis that we at Enterprise have been conducting for so many years now, and David's reverse speech pursuits, have separately and in a truly double-blind study honed in, converged on this identification of the hidden agenda. And David has been very perplexed. In fact, he will tell you about his bafflement at many of the references that he has been finding in running through the tapes, because I provided him after the second Bell presentation with, what, 12, 15 hours?
At 12 hours of tape, which translates to probably 100 or 200 hours of analysis time. So there's a lot of tape.
A lot of tape and not much time to go through it. So when I tell you that this is a work in progress, and we really forced the issue because of the politics, because we wanted to be here tonight with Surveyor in orbit and the press all gathered just up the street at JPL, what I'm hoping is that after the press conference up there breaks up, a few of them will wander down here to snicker and will have their eyes opened in the process. The very fact that the demonstration was noted by CNN and on NBC and on many of the local affiliates is evidence that what we're doing is not going unnoticed by and large. And of course, one of the key follow-ups to what you're going to see this evening is that David and I are going to be presenting very large portions of this material on the World Wide Web on our respective websites, so that you can peruse the photographs and listen to the audio and see the remarkable correlations for yourself. And again, both of these technologies, both of these investigations are democratizable. This is not something that only David and I know how to do. It's something that anyone who wants to take the time and trouble to learn the truth can do for him or herself. And the advantage of having the internet, of having the World Wide Web, of having this incredible tool at our disposal to bypass the major media and or filters who selectively choose what they choose to put on the air or to highlight or to accent, is in fact why ultimately I think that this information is going to leverage us to a totally different position politically in terms of NASA and these two ongoing missions. With that as prologue, let me have the video. Turn off the slides, please. And I want to run you a clip because I want to show you exactly what we can expect in the next few months. Courtesy again of NASA, we are going to show you the computer animation, which they have spent so much of our money in lovingly preparing, which basically shows the, when it warms up, the Mars Observer spacecraft. This is the Mars Surveyor in orbit, and as you know, the retro rocket burn took place, you know, retrograde. Spacecraft is approaching Mars at tens of thousands of miles per hour, and upon a computer command from inside, the rocket burns in the forward direction, slowing the vehicle, and eventually, after about 22 minutes, it loses enough energy to be captured by Mars gravity and proceeds to orbit. Now, initially, that orbit, we were told, would be about 45 hours. Ultimately, they want a two-hour circular orbit. It's initially a very long elliptical orbit. So, the problem which this mission is technologically addressing for the first time in an operational capacity, although Magellan at Venus did do a kind of a test of it, is a concept called aerobraking, where they carefully position the spacecraft so that these panels dip into the lower or the upper atmosphere and literally through friction, through drag in the stratosphere of Mars, energy will be subtracted on every pass over the low point of the orbit for months and months and months. And because of standard celestial mechanics, the orbit will shrink. But the low point doesn't shrink. It's the high point that shrinks. So from the initial 45-hour orbit, it gets down to 42 hours and 39 hours. and 37 hours, et cetera, et cetera. And I believe something like 400 passes over the next few months will be required to reduce the energy until they arrive in the desired polar two-hour circular orbit a couple of hundred miles above the Martian surface. Now, this is the first views of Mars taken by the Mallon camera, the replacement camera from Mars Observer, as the spacecraft a few days ago approached. And because of computer technology, they're able to now give us a full disk view, give it to us rotating. This is time lapse. This is Mars as it would appear in black and white as you're approaching. This, of course, is a safe view. All right. This is how they can showcase their neat new toys, because nothing interesting will be seen. This is the spacecraft itself. These are the solar panels folded up, which, by the way, act kind of as the wings in this error-breaking technique. And there are various instruments on top. There are cameras and spectrometers, and there's a high-gain antenna folded up. This is the Mallon camera, which is a very large telescope, basically looking down at Mars. This is the thermal emission spectrometer. This is loaded for bear to find all kinds of neat stuff. It's a shame they're not going to tell us what they really find. It's truly a shame because, of course, without us, they wouldn't be able to do this. This is in the clean room. I'm not sure whether it's at the Cape or at JPL. And this now is the geometry of the actual mission. The instruments are not mounted on a movable platform. They are fixed on the body of the spacecraft, and they aim straight down, which is an interesting technological backsliding. I mean, you would think in this era of incredible technological precision that we could put a spacecraft in orbit where you could actually aim the instruments at something you wanted to look at. But in fact, it can only look straight down. This is the camera mapping GORS, and this is the wide-angle camera, and every orbit it will give us a full-color view of Mars, which again will look pretty on TV and will tell us absolutely nothing in terms of things you want to see. This is the laser altimeter, and there are other instruments. There are infrared mapping instruments. This is the thermal emission spectrometer, which is basically going to be looking at heat sources and mineralogical composition and, again, producing these global maps. But the resolution is miles compared to feet, so nothing, you know, dangerous will be revealed. This is now the magnetometer investigation looking at the presumed interaction of the solar wind with Mars. Mars, of all the planets that we have visited, appears to have no discernible magnetic field, and that's a major mystery. And this is the launch which I was privileged to get thrown out of. No, not quite. This poster down here almost got us thrown out, and of course they use it as an excuse to keep us from covering Pathfinder, but this is the mission as it was leaving the Cape in November of 1996. All right, end tape, pause tape, pause. Thank you. Lights. So, that sets up why we are here. Because if you have been pinning your hopes on a resolution of the Cydonia question, and through it, the larger questions, you know, like, are we alone? You know, are the Greys real? Stuff like that. Mars Surveyor is not going to give us the answer. Now, why not? Technically, it can. Technically, it should. Politically, it won't. With a caveat. One of the things that I'm going to ask you to do tonight, all of you who came, is to do something proactive. Now, obviously, I can only ask if you are convinced that something needs to be done. But for those who are convinced after the evening is over, I'm going to ask you to send faxes to John Holloman at CNN and Ted Koppel at ABC. And I want you to describe your reaction as an American citizen, as a taxpayer, to what you have seen this evening and heard. Because unless we get people of integrity, and these two gentlemen do have integrity, they are a little bit blinded by the idea that if something like this were going on, they would know about it. In fact, that's part of the very careful and skillful manipulation. But if you, the constituency, let them know that having sat through an evening and seen this data, you are moved to want to know what the truth really is, and you believe that they can serve as the harbingers of the truth if they are so inclined, politically it will help us when I make the phone calls and basically ask for the meeting, which I intend to do subsequent to this evening. But it's going to be very important to have that political momentum going in so that, in fact, they will take the call and they will sit down and look at the data that we are going to show you tonight. Now, I hope that I can count on you to follow through and do that. On our website, there are the fax numbers for both networks. If I'd really thought ahead, remember this is a work in progress, I would have had them up here on a sheet of paper. What we can probably do is before the end of the evening, if someone has a computer they can tie into the World Wide Web, we in fact can pull up the faxes. David is pointing to his screen. All we need is a phone line, right? And there is a phone line somewhere.
Well, I just need my cell
phone. Oh, okay. God, he's equipped. This may be more rough than I thought. Okay, well, that is prologue. Let me explain to you about the changes in the program. One of the key people who was supposed to be here tonight was Ron Nix. Ron is a certified engineering geologist. He has about 35 years of experience. He had a family emergency in Indiana, and unfortunately, a couple days ago, called me and said there was no way he'd be able to get out here, and he was crushed because he looked forward to interacting one-on-one with all of us and with the program this evening. What we're going to do is I had him prepare a tape, a video, which I'm going to show, of his thoughts and analyses of what he is seeing in these photographs. So we're going to run that. And then along about 11 o'clock our time, maybe 10:30, 11, we have arranged that we can have a live phone hookup so that from home, if there are questions that you would like to ask someone of his geological background, you'll be able to ask him directly from here. And I'm sorry, but that's the way the cookie crumbles. We've had the most interesting run of strange events occurring on trying to put this program together. He had computer crashes, and as you'll hear on the audio of the tape that Ron sent, there's some weird noise, whistling, I mean, that should not be there, and we're going to try to filter out most of it, which I think we can do, but it's going to be hard. And Tim, one of our friends here from She Who Remembers, what a name for a production company. I mean, that's one heck of a name for a production company in a town which is known for its wild production company. I mean, it's dripping with interesting symbolism. Anyway, Tim will ride the levels, and it's very clear. I mean, you can hear very clearly what Ron is saying. And what I will do, because of the quality of the video, is I will run through some of the imagery and show you on the computer what, in fact, he is pointing out as interesting and provocative. As a live replacement, substitution, we have up here a gentleman, Rick Savard, who up until a few days ago, I guess it was Phoenix where we met briefly, and then you faxed us at Enterprise West. It's so nice to be able to say that now, Enterprise West. Ring to it. And he faxed me with this kind of unbelieving, have you noticed what's lying around the lander kind of query? And Rick is head of a loose confederation of people who are growing, I understand, called the Near Pathfinder Anomaly Analysis Group. Okay. The acronym of which is, I'm not even going to try to, describe. And what I've asked Rick to do is to present in the second half of this evening, because we are going to have a break, all right? We've been going for a little over half an hour. We will have a break probably 9-ish, 9:30, so that we can all stretch and get, whatever they still have out there, and then come back for David. Because David is definitely something you're going to want to have a seventh-inning stretch before we launch into that for. So what we're going to do is to have Rick, put on some of the material that he's identified, and he comes equipped with laptop and discs. Are we all set on? Oh, great. Okay. So this is important because these two gentlemen, we deliberately have not shared any data other than what's on the web. I wanted independent opinion. On David, I was really betting that there would be gold in them thar hills based on what little bits I had heard on the Bell shows. And it turns out that in spades, we have hit the mother lode. Boy, have we got some interesting stuff. In fact,
he is
so boggled because, again, the context of what he's been finding had no referent in what he thought he might be finding, but in fact coincides with the pictures. So with that as prologue, let me show you how we got into this, because it's very important that you understand the cornerstone of why we are so confident now in what we are presenting. Because for some reason, on this Pathfinder mission, we got live, uncensored data for a few minutes until somebody figured it out that they had been snookered. And then the curtains and the filters went down. And if I'm really lucky and this technology works, I'll be able to show you a couple of those very curious events that happened even as we were seeing the missions. So let me run the second part of that tape, all right? And what I'm going to do is to describe part of this story, the early part, through the eyes of Holloman over at CNN, which is kind of our window on reality these days. Oh, before I do that, all right, pause. At the close of the evening, in the second half, I'm going to bring a friend and colleague, Nick Skouras, up here. And Nick, where are you? Oh, there he is, okay. He hates the limelight. He's just kind of hanging out over there in the shadows. Nick is a, 6-month research associate of Enterprise. He and his significant other, Dana, who has become of inestimable value to the Enterprise mission, took a train from Albuquerque to Brevard County College, Community College in Florida, for the Mars Pathfinder launch, Mars Surveyor launch, last November. And one thing led to another, and I was able to snare both of them into the tentacles of Enterprise, and they are gone. They're hopelessly committed now. And it turned out that Nick, as a independent research student, had been quietly pursuing for years an area of our investigation that I have never told anyone that I was interested in, which had to do with the personalities and background and politics that led to the formation of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory itself here in Pasadena, and collaterally Caltech. And because that investigation has turned up some remarkable parallels, remarkable clues to what we have found in the Pathfinder imaging and to what David has found in the reversals of the press conferences, I asked Nick to put together a presentation. Nick has never spoken in public before. You will be very kind to Nick. He has done a stunning job with the assistance of our Planetary Horizons editor, Susan Caravan, who lent her editorial skills, even though she is in New York tonight at the UN and cannot be here. And together they have crafted a very elegant, and I use that term judiciously, of the background of why we are all here. Because as with all good pursuits of honesty and truth, if you just keep going long enough, the pieces fall into place. And what you're going to hear from Nick is some remarkable, again, independent confirmation as to what we figured out from the data side of the ledger. Now, that's a pretty tall order to all smash into a few hours. Okay, with that as a background, let me have the next piece of video, okay? Because all of this began on July 4th. It began in the morning of July 4th with a series of reports on CNN discussing and laying out the impending Pathfinder landing.
Hello, and welcome to this CNN special presentation. I'm John Holloman. Today, we're taking you where no one has gone before, to Mars. With the landing of the Pathfinder probe just moments away, about 6.5 moments, we will eavesdrop on mission control at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. We will hear from Donna Shirley, the head of NASA's Mars Exploration Program. Our own Jim Hill is there. CNN's Jennifer Author is just across town in Pasadena at the Planet Fest celebration. And we'll wait to find out, is there life on the red planet, or can there be? And will the Pathfinder survive the basketball drop on the Martian surface? Jim Hill's with us now.
Well, it really is a blackout, especially after we land, because we actually turn the transmitter off, because we have to operate completely on battery power for the next 4 hours, because there's no sun. We're landing in the dark. And so in order to conserve the batteries for the operations so that the spacecraft can actually talk to us, we'll be turning the transmitter off once we're on the ground. And that all happens automatically.
Now, what we're looking at right now would be basically the entry and in the heat shield, is that right?
Right, that's right. The friction of the atmosphere with the heat shield, which is the front there that's turning red, is heating up, is slowing the spacecraft down due to the drag, just like when you put your hand out the car window. But it's going so fast, at about 16,000 miles an hour, that it's also...
Okay, thank you, Donna. We're going to take a break right now and go to live mission control and see what's going on there.
We're going to open the parachutes as the dynamic pressure. At the time of parachute motor deployment is about 600 newtons per meter squared. Although the vehicle is still traveling at nearly 1,000 miles per hour at the time that the parachute deploys, because the atmosphere is so thin, this dynamic pressure corresponds to only a fraction of a pound per square inch. We expect that the parachute will deploy in about 15 seconds. The events will follow will occur in rapid succession under the control of the onboard software. I'll report these events as they are expected to occur.
He said that
parachute should now be deployed. Is slowing down rapidly because of parachute deployment. The heat shield should separate in about 3, 2, 1, 0 seconds. The next event is lander separation. That should occur in about 5 seconds. When that occurs, the lander will descend in about 10 seconds down the bridle. Lander separation should have occurred right about now. We should be switching from one antenna to another antenna under a flight software control. This is an antenna that proves our ability to see the signal during this descent phase.
The cheer that you heard about 1 minute ago was an indication that the parachute had opened. There is a change in the signal strength meter there in Mars Mission Control.
The spacecraft should be approximately a mile above the surface of Mars. There's a lot of uncertainty in the timing from here on out because of the variation in the atmosphere.
The big picture on your screen is animation telling you what we and they think is happening right now.
The spacecraft should have passed the 600 mark.
That over the next couple of days, several other chemists came by and
hiring. And bridle should be cut.
The commentator has to say should have now, because
methylene dioxide and minerals, you know, methylene dioxide.
The Mars Pathfinder, there is no camera to take pictures to equal this animation that we're looking at. But over the next couple of minutes, if it successfully gets to the Martian surface and if it concludes its bouncing around on the surface of Mars, there is a possibility of a very weak radio signal from Mars,
which will be picked up by the...
Sort of avoid the illegalities of actually ever possessing any substances and instead just, you know, have pictures.
It's barely visible. That's a very good sign, everybody.
That's what they were hoping for. The Pathfinder has successfully touched down on the surface of Mars.
Okay, stop making it.
All right. What I'm doing while we're listening to that is I'm working on an image which I captured yesterday. Literally, this is how rapid this is. Demonstrating a couple of the things that I'm going to talk about momentarily. Before I show you that, let me give you a couple of pieces of context. This is now the overall profile of the mission. Tetrahedral spacecraft lands on Mars at some time in the early afternoon Pacific time on July 4th. It lands at 19.5 degrees, which is very interesting considering that it's a tetrahedron, and a tetrahedron in a sphere's points touch at 19.5. That, of course, is very indicative of something, and now we understand fully, we think, what that something is. That was not an accident. That's part of this theme that is converging on some answers, finally. Then it lands successfully on these airbags, bounces around a few times, comes to rest, the pedals open, and the rest you will hear described very shortly. So let's resume with the tape, okay? But that's what I wanted to show you was the profile with the NASA animation. Now he's going to go to Donna Shirley, who is the head of Mars Exploration for NASA.
I told you were Mars. Is that an accurate description?
What, me?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Boy, am I pumped. Wow, we never expected to get the signal this way. We never expected it. I mean, this is the best news imaginable. This is terrific.
Tell me what it means.
Computer program onboard the lander completely autonomously has found the sun, and then they were able to actually point the high-gain antenna.
Now skipped ahead several hours because after the landing and the spacecraft had to do a few things, housekeeping and all that, and she just has described how it had to all by itself find the Earth in terms of its computer program and point this antenna, which is a little disc-shaped antenna about the size of this podium, at the Earth, which was 120 million miles away, in order for us to see pictures. One of the things that she's going to brag about is the fact that unlike what opponents have claimed, NASA was so open and forthcoming and honest on this mission that they were giving absolute unvarnished live pictures to the entire world. And she'll talk about the risks to science and the risks to reputation and how the agency really wants to be open and forthcoming by giving us live pictures. There's another part of her description, however, which is actually much more interesting. Because, and this is a little complicated, so follow carefully. The initial computer program in the spacecraft, when it sent the first pictures, it was apparently only programmed, and she should know because she runs the program, to photograph the edges of the panels where it's sitting on its airbags to make sure that those bags were tucked up under the panels so that the rover could drive off without any impediment. It's obvious from what she is saying that when the pictures start coming in, she and no one else in the project expected the number of pictures they received, or the quality of the pictures, and the fact that they were not just looking at the edges of the spacecraft, like walking around like that, all right, but in fact looked at the entire horizon, gave us panoramic views live from Mars, uncensored. And because of the pattern of the data, it has become obvious to us in the last several weeks that we are not the only ones who are very, very unhappy with the politics of the hidden agenda at JPL and NASA regarding Mars and other missions. That in fact there must be program scientists and engineers on the project who are in fact as unhappy as we are, and who in demonstration of their unhappiness have staged some kind of technical revolt. Now how do we know that? Because if they hadn't, we wouldn't have the data we're going to show you tonight. It's that simple. We live in a town, you live in a town, which is known around the world for being able to create synthetic reality. A few minutes ago, there was a fellow that approached me who works at, I believe, the Disney Studio, who works here in town, and said, you know, I work in the computer, the CGI, Division, if there's anything we can do to help, by all means, just let me know. You've all seen Jurassic Park. You've seen Terminator 1 and 2. You've seen, you know, Indiana Jones. You know what the state of the art of the industry is. In fact, if these scientists and engineers really wanted to successfully pull off the perfect scam, the perfect crime, visually, I may not be able to get around David, but visually, we would never have had a clue. And what has been intriguing me since we got onto this trail in the last few weeks has been how far back did this revolt extend? And it's obvious now from what you're going to see on this tape in the next couple of minutes that unbeknownst to Donna Shirley and the others who have been masterminding the hidden agenda, and we will document that assertion, the folks under her and them, the engineers, apparently secretly loaded additional instructions into the spacecraft computer to take a lot more pictures and send them down in that brief window of live transmission than they expected. And I want you with that now as a lens to listen carefully to what Ms. Shirley is going to tell us.
At the Earth, and so we are now starting to get a signal from the high-gain antenna, which means that we will be getting the pictures back.
A lot of cheering and yelling and screaming and attaboy and attagirl going on in this room.
More handshakes and cheers.
We have four frames in lock so far.
I suspect that the pictures have started to come in.
Donna, there are a lot of computer monitors in that room, including two that we can't look directly into, where the shift leader is looking. Where will the first picture come in?
Well, I don't know which monitor the picture comes in on, but they're supposed to go up on NASA Select right away. So within some small period of time, we should be able to pull them off of the NASA Select feed.
Okay, we have an internet site here that plugs in to the Jet Propulsion Lab, and I believe the pictures are coming in on that internet site right now. We'll check that and pop it up, and we may get it as quickly as the folks at NASA Select get it. We'll find out. And
Let me explain what these pictures will be of. Mm-hmm. If you can get down on our little model here, where these pictures will be of the edges of the solar arrays to make sure that the airbags are neatly tucked in under the solar arrays and that they're not lopping over onto the pedals and blocking the pedals. And we're particularly interested in the pedal that the rover is on because we need to be able to deploy the ramps off the ends of the, off the edges of the solar panel so that the rover can crawl off on the ramps and get down onto the surface. And that's the next big event after the pictures coming in. Now, these pictures that we're getting are just little black and white images, very highly compressed, just of ugly little airbags and possibly the rover's wheels, so that the rover's part of the rover and part of the ramps that are going to unfold for the rover to get down.
So I'm sitting live watching this and recording, of course, everything, and suddenly we see this vast volume of data coming in, which surprised everybody, including Holloman. That's the reason we're here tonight. So the uncover-up from within the system itself began before the launch in the programming of the onboard computer to show us Mars for real. And it only gets better from there. Play the tape, please.
They're not going to be very pretty. The pretty pictures are going to come in at about 6:30. Yep, I bet you a picture just came in.
That's probably an image right there.
Yeah, there it is. There it is. That is an image. Okay, oh my gosh, it's beautiful.
What is it?
Okay, well, we can see a little bit of Mars. There's rocks. There's the airbags just sticking up just a little bit. They look just fine. But we've got Mars. We've got rocks on Mars. And boy, is
is that a rover wheel? Was that?
Yeah, that was a rover wheel there a minute ago. Now, I can't tell what this is. Boy, these are hard to see on this little bitty screen here.
Donna, CNN is going to try eventually to get a bigger TV.
That's okay, a solar panel there, John.
See the solar arrays on it? You can see that. And this must be, look at those airbags. They're just beautiful. They're all tucked in very neatly. They're not on top of the pedals at all.
Which really means you're in excellent position to get the rover off.
Excellent position to get the rover off. Now there'll be some more coming in, because what they want to do is to take pictures all around the edges of the pedals to make sure that there's no interference.
Will they put them together then in a mosaic, so to speak?
Yes, they will, but they probably won't even bother to mosaic these pictures, because what they're going to do is wait for the color pictures to come down. Now that they know the high-gain antenna is correctly pointed, the next images that come down will be the color images, and then they're going to make a really beautiful mosaic that'll have color, that'll have the rover in it. The rover will be right there in the middle of the picture, and
now this is, you know, we should be pretty excited. These are the first pictures in 21 odd years from the surface of Mars.
Absolutely, absolutely.
This is a tremendous event unfolding right here now.
And there's rocks right there, so the rover won't even have to go very far to find rocks. I mean, this is just, it's beautiful.
Barely has to go off the limb and get to work with the pedal with the alpha spectra spectrometer, proton, X-ray, proton spectrometer.
Alpha proton X-ray spectrometer. Very good.
And it doesn't have to move very far. Yes, John.
Let me just jump in. These pictures are coming in very rapid succession, it looks to me like. Is that an indication that the high-gain antenna is doing precisely what it's supposed to be? I mean, I've seen seven different views show up on this computer screen just in the past few minutes while we've been talking.
Absolutely. This means the high-gain antenna is not only pointed at the
Earth. There's a good wider photo.
Oh, wow. That's hard to see, though. Oh, here it goes. This is one of the pedal actuators that you can see here. One of the motors that actually opens the pedal up like that.
Does it look good to you, Donna?
It looks beautiful to me.
Now, is the vehicle taking, this is all pre-programmed to take these? You haven't commanded it to do any of this.
We haven't said a word to the vehicle yet. These are all pre-programmed, and there's going to be something like, I forget how many of these, but they're 80-to-1 compression. So if these are this good, you can imagine what the real pictures, when they get in color and full and not compressed, are going to look like.
Compare these, just from what we're looking at, to the Viking pictures.
Right.
I mean, these are probably better than the Viking pictures.
Well, not yet, but they sure will be. They'll be a lot better. Now, see, this here is showing where these pictures are being taken, this little pie chart.
Yes.
It's showing where the pictures are actually being taken with respect to the lander, so that you can see. Now, here's some, here's some close-ups.
So,
and see the airbags. There's a little bit of airbag sticking out.
That's on the right side of the screen, John. That's the airbag and the wheel. And on the left side.
Airbag over here.
And what they're trying to do now,
a little airbag.
Yeah, Donna and John, they're trying to begin to mosaic these pictures together. Those two pictures, they appear to be together at this point. So the picture that we're getting is bigger and bigger and bigger, and
very good.
More and more fascinating. Donna, I don't know how well you can see on that tiny little TV set where you are.
Not well.
Yeah.
Not well.
On the left side of the two pictures, there appears to be a little black blob sort of in the center of that picture. Just
this here.
Yeah. Is that a normal looking thing to you?
Actually, I'm not sure what that is, but it's too regular to be abnormal.
I see. Okay.
It's probably I know what it is. When the panels are latched together, they come together, and if we can look down at our little model, and we can't, it doesn't do you any good. We can't see it. Anyway, when the panels are folded up, they're latched together, and that's one of the latches. And how you release that latch is you fire a pyrotechnic device that pulls the pin out, and then the rover pedals can come apart, and that's what that is.
Yep. This is amazing. I mean,
and look at those rocks. Look at those rocks.
John,
there's rocks right there.
The upper left of that picture on your left, Donna's referring to those rocks that are right off of the pedal.
Yep, I can see them out there. Yeah, we have
I'm having trouble telling what the thing on the right is.
On the right-hand side, is that the rover wheel that we're looking at?
No. It doesn't look like it.
No.
It's really hard to tell from this tiny little monitor.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to get more pictures.
It appears to be rocks.
We're going to get more pictures. Oh, yeah.
That's right. And as we get more. Donna, I was going to ask you before we went into a news conference a little while ago, if this were an ideal world and everything worked exactly the way it was supposed to, how many pictures would we see from the surface of Mars over the next 7 days?
Oh, lousy. Lots and lots. I don't know.
Hundreds and hundreds.
I don't know how to count them. Hundreds and hundreds. That's right. And now they'll be taking pictures of different objects. So first they'll do a complete scan of the horizon with all 12 different colors.
Yeah.
This camera takes pictures in stereo in 12 different colors.
And the people back at your end are wearing 3D glasses, some of them, to get the,
right.
the depth and all on these.
That's because these pictures are coming in stereo.
Could our viewers do the same thing? If they watch these pictures at home, if they had 3D glasses on, could they see some of the relief in the pictures?
No. Okay. No, these pictures have to be very carefully processed, and it's a very special, very high technology silicon graphics computer that makes them into 3D.
Okay.
And you have to have very special glasses to see it.
There's a new photo up there now, John.
One.
It looks like, is that airbags?
Yeah, that's airbags around the edge.
Around the edge.
Okay, now this is of the edge, and see the airbags are tucked in close to the pedal, and there's another rock. Right there, and that's a light rock. So we've so far got dark rocks and light rocks, which is exactly
what you wanted.
What we wanted. Now, I don't know if these are really dark and really light because we won't be able to tell until we get there. Oh, wow,
there you
there's
go.
A real close-up. Okay.
Yeah,
yeah see, this is this is the edge of the pedal, and it looks just fine to me.
Little Mission commentary in the background there is the folks in the control room with that computer. Are talking about these pictures. We all, you can hear a lot of background noise there, and we'll continue to listen up as we hear what these people have to say. We just got word that a different sequence of photographs from the surface of Mars is about.
This is Story Musgrave, who is one of the NASA astronauts. In fact, he is the oldest NASA astronaut. His last mission was a few months ago, a month or so ago. And he is now in the process, I believe, of either retiring or he's not on flight status anymore. And he was one of the guests, expert guests that they had on, you know, during this coverage. It's during this sequence, which is just before a second set of pictures, which John is about to announce, that are coming down. Because during the first sequence, they suddenly developed a computer problem at Goldstone. And Brian, one of the managers, one of the technical managers, came out and talked to CNN and said that they had a lockup problem or something, and that they had to then recycle and get a second transmission of images. That's when things began to move off the reservation, as near as we can reconstruct. But what is remarkable about this sequence is that from the early evening on the West Coast, you know, around 5, 6 o'clock, 6:30, Pacific time, to around 8 o'clock, 2 hours later, an awful lot of people watching CNN, looking at their monitors, looking at their TV sets, had come to the same conclusion. And listen to what they told CNN. Play tape.
Coming in to Jet Propulsion Lab Mission Control there in California. We're going to watch those pictures as they come in, I would reckon. And as we continue to look at the pictures that came down a couple of hours ago, until we get the new pictures, let's go back and look at the old ones. Some of our viewers have called and asked about the shape of some of the rocks. Now, not in this picture. Those rocks look like rocks. But there are some that we have seen throughout the evening that look almost as if they might have been carved. I mean, they have very, very straight
very square
curves on the corners. And as we look at that, I'd like you, Story, because you've got a certain interest, a great interest in geology, to tell me how that could come about. If we can, I don't know if we can find one of those pictures while you're looking at it, but I've seen several tonight that look sort of like they've been cut pieces of stone. How would that occur naturally on Mars?
And I agree with you very much, John. They look fractured. They look almost as if something broke the rocks, and then after the breaking, there was minimum erosion to round off the corners.
I guess that tells you a little bit about the winds and the sandstorms and things on the surface of Mars. Probably hadn't been much much windstorm or sandstorm action on those rocks to keep the sides of them as smooth as they are.
Or it's fairly recent.
Yeah, that's a good point. And we're going to learn, I guess, a good bit about the age of these river valleys as soon as we can get a sample of this stuff from the surface of Mars back to Earth so that we can do some sort of dating on it. Maybe carbon dating would work on samples of Martian soil and the pieces that will come back. I was asking Donna Shirley and a couple of other people earlier today how long ago this river basin had water in it. She said, don't have a clue, won't have a clue till we get some of this stuff back on Earth and can analyze it. But there are some of these rocks that seem to have fairly square corners. This is just fascinating to look at to me, Story.
It sure is. It's amazing the diversity that you get in planets that all got formed in the solar system, depending upon where they got formed, what their orbital mechanics, how far out they are, what their rotations are, and what their chemistry was.
You know, Story, some of those look almost as what you'd see out in the West out here in the United States, where you have the great rivers that carved these canyons through there, and they really smooth them out over the eons of time.
Very familiar territory.
Story Musgrave, I'm told that the day you came to work for NASA, at the end of the Apollo days, it was your assumption you were going to be the first human being to walk on Mars. Is that true?
I thought we would have been there in 30 or 35 years. And with the acceleration in technology that we had, I think it was reasonable to expect that within 30 or 35 years we would be there. And I was a long-term investor.
Yeah.
And I was interested in life out there and in medicine.
Well, you know, your life's not over yet. How old are you today?
I'm going on 62 next month.
All right. Well, see, I mean, you got time, and you're a young 62. We got to take a quick break, Story. We'll be back with you and John Zarella, the rest of our crew. What a day this has been. To all our viewers who are sending us email and calling us up to ask questions of our guests, I thank you all for being with us today. Big day for CNN.
Okay. If I can have the video off and the computer on, and I can make this transition here, I want to show you something interesting. While you've been watching this, what I've been doing is playing around a little bit with one of the images that I captured from the tape last night that was coming in during the sequence that you just watched. We have done absolutely no processing to this image at all. All I've done is to change the contrast and throw away the color. And this is off there's an airbag. Let me show you where the airbag is. This is one of the airbags right here. Is this laser actually working?
For a second.
Seems awfully dim. Okay. All right, right there. All right, there's the airbag. Okay. And this is a part of the spacecraft here. These are little latches. And this is noise. Okay, well, if I had a more powerful laser, I could... Okay. Can you see it now? All right. All right. This is the airbag in the lower left-hand corner, this white thing, all right? That's just part of an airbag. And the spacecraft is down here, the white thing over on the right, all right? And just above the breaking news is more spacecraft. The actual Mars surface starts right above this white thing here. So from here up is all Mars. And it looks like ratty Swiss cheese. In fact, it looks like ratty geometric Swiss cheese. And during the transmission, during the live shot, the director in the control room obviously got very intrigued with this, even on his monitors. And so what he did was to go to a close-up of a portion of this. And if I can work this properly, he zoomed in on the upper left-hand quadrant. And what you can clearly see here is some astonishing multi-leveled geometry of a 3D structure that is so ungeological as to not be funny. Now, we have done nothing except just enhance the contrast. This is what we were never supposed to see. Now, let me show you how we, in the process of working with this data, improved on the quality of this imagery, because that process, which you yourself can do, if you have a computer and you recorded the video, you can do what's called a frame grab, and you can, in fact, duplicate everything you're going to see tonight. Let me back down here. Look at the geometry. In fact, I'll tell you what, let me use the arrow here. All right, let me get an arrow. Well, one of these things is an arrow. Well, I'll use this, all right? Look at the grid here. You see these little squares? You see this honeycomb? Like a 3D deteriorated geometric structure? Now, the scale of this is pretty large. I mean, it's probably several feet square because you're looking down with about a 40, 50 degree field of view, because each of these frames is not all that small. And it's astonishingly regular. Now, it's eroded regular, which makes it difficult for non-experts to see. But it's definitely, as I was just going through these, I'm watching them on the screen as the computer is capturing them, and I said, whoa, that's weird. Now, there were other weirdnesses that that were captured. But before I get into weirdnesses, let me describe what we've been doing and how we've been doing it, all right? This is good old John, all right? Here's John. What we've been doing is basically taking the video which was displayed on the monitors at CNN and broadcast around the world by satellite. And what we have done is to simply record them on videotape. Now, the quality of the capture depends on the quality of the tape recorder system. So if we were a broadcast facility, we'd record on Beta SP or digital or three-quarter, but in fact, we're using, to start with, plain ordinary home VHS and Super VHS, which has good resolution but not super resolution. The next step in this procedure, all right, and I actually should back up here, and we'll get rid of John. All right, we don't need him anymore. All right, and I'll show you this. The next step in the procedure is to understand the root of the data as it comes all the way from Mars. All right, this is the routing. Okay, it starts out at the Pathfinder lander, relayed by radio to JPL. Now, in fact, it doesn't go directly to JPL. It goes to some of the huge, several hundred foot antennas positioned all around the world and is relayed back to JPL by satellite, but that's kind of immaterial. It winds up at JPL and is processed by computer. They then rebroadcast it up to a communication satellite down to, in fact, there are a couple other steps in here, down to Goddard, which is outside Washington, which is NASA's television control center, which puts it out on a television satellite channel that NASA has called NASA Select, broadcast back up to a communication satellite, and then downlinked not only to networks all over the world who simply point their antennas at the satellite and capture the signal, but also anybody who has a backyard satellite dish. And some cable operators, like the one in the town that I live in, has a dedicated satellite dish aimed at the NASA satellite all the time. So now, 24 hours a day, we can monitor NASA. In fact, he set it up just for us. Very nice of him. All right? He turns out to be a former employee of the National Security Agency who has come over to our side. It's nice we've got some of them. Anyway, it's been extraordinary because that's how I was able to get all those tapes for David, because normally those things are not broadcast in their entirety on CNN after the first couple of days. So we're getting assistance with this. Anyway, once it gets to Atlanta to CNN, it's broadcast back up on satellite all over the world and comes in by a cable or satellite to homes all over this planet. That's what you're seeing here, okay? Now, all we have done to start this investigation is to simply take and record this off-the-air live video, and you'll see that I've got a series of frames here, something like a dozen. The problem with the video that you're seeing here, all right, let me show you the comparison, is it is only one frame. All right? Now, if you've ever noticed television, you notice that television is noisy. That's the snow and the speckle in the background. So if you're trying to look at data on a television frame, you're competing with the noise. Now, there's a very well-known standard physics solution to the problem. It's called beating down the noise. And the way you do it, let me go back to the other picture now. All right. The way you do it is you take a number of frames, and television comes in at 30 frames per second. Let me expand this up. Okay. 30 frames per second. And so what you do is you simply stack the frames. You add the frames together in the computer, registered perfectly, one over the other, over the other, over the other. And the noise goes down as the square root of the number of frames you add. That means if I add two frames together, the noise goes down by a factor of 1.4. Three frames, 1.72. That's almost 2 to 1. 10 frames, almost 3 to 1, and so on. So you can see that even with relatively simple technology, it is now possible to compete with the big guys in terms of looking at this data. And this is where NASA really painted themselves into a corner. Because in those first few minutes, they sent us hundreds of frames of real video from the surface of Mars that we don't think, I strongly suspect, were not supposed to come in unvarnished. And in fact, if you compare the first live pictures with the pictures that came in on the second feed, you already begin to see significant changes in the pictures. And that's the kind of detail work that Rick and ourselves will be doing in the weeks ahead, is to meticulously compare point by point these images. So what do we see if we go through all this, all right? This is where I need to go and find another image. All right, so let me save this. Let me get rid of this because I don't really want to save it. I just wanted to show you what the process was. Let me show you what the frames originally look like, all right? Let me pull up a copy of one of these frames and show you what a raw picture looks like when it comes in. All right? This is what it looks like, all right? This is in color. Now, even at this resolution and with the RGB, you know, gray levels of the RGB algorithm, you can see that there is some very weird geometry which should not exist on Mars. Now, you'll notice that there are some funny lines. That's because this is a non-interlaced frame, and there's an algorithm which can get rid of that, which we also apply. The point is that this is all very standard stuff, and it produced some pretty exciting results. So let me go now, and normally what I can do would be this, which would be to get rid of that so I can do all this in secret up here. But because I want to show you exactly the steps, I'm just going to leave it up so that you can kind of follow along. All right. I need to go to this file. Then I need, what do I need? I need this one. There. All right. Let me show you this. Okay. One of the frames that we got very intrigued with as it was coming in was this frame, all right? This is the one that's on the web. This is now, and I need to step back and give you another piece of information. As we were pursuing the flow of data, we started carefully comparing the stuff on the net, on the NASA website, with the stuff that had been downlinked live. Now, keep in mind that this adding of frames is a very time-consuming and laborious process. And, you know, we also have applied a program to it called a Fraxel Resolution Enhancement and a couple of other programs, one of which was used by the Hubble Space Telescope to retrieve resolution information from the blurred Hubble images, which cost us a pretty penny, and we had to get through the back door out of Canada. But the bottom line is that you can, in fact, look at the web material and compare it one-to-one against the live stuff to give yourself a feeling of confidence. And one of the things that we noted immediately is that the live pictures, after we'd put them through this very careful process of reducing the noise and bringing out the signal and the resolution that was present in that data, tallied remarkably well with the data on NASA's own site, not from the first day, but from the second day. And let me show you where it lives, all right? This is the final product. Let me go and get you the raw data. Because on the NASA website, I don't want to do that. All right. On the NASA website, on Sol 2, NASA used to have a problem in terms of relating Earth days to Mars days. They didn't want to call the Martian day a day because it would get very confused. The Martian day is slightly longer than the Earth day. Mars spins in 24 hours, 37 minutes. The Earth spins in 24 hours. So they started back during Viking 20 years ago calling Martian days Sols, S-O-L, which of course means sun. So on Sol 2, on the second Martian day, but taken on Sol 1, on the first Martian day, NASA gave us this. And it will take a moment here to read out, all right, because these are large files. And then it will paint itself very nicely on the screen. All right. This is a 360-degree panorama with the IMP camera, the image camera on the lander, in the undeployed position, stowed down, crouched down before the mast was released. And let me expand this by doing... Well, I need three hands here. Nope. Okay, what you can see here, if I do this correctly, is... This is a 360 panorama along the horizon, and you see in the foreground various parts of the spacecraft, antennas and masts. Here's the rover sitting on the solar panel before deployment. In the background, you'll see these funny-looking peaks that we're going to talk about shortly. And this is the rock Yogi. All right, we'll talk about rocks and their funny names. All right, and that's the end of the panorama. Now, that's not totally 360. It's actually just short of 360, but it's close enough for folk music. And most important is it appeared to be, and this is critical, when we compared it against the live frames that we had so painstakingly and carefully processed, lo and behold, the remarkable weird details that we found in the frames corresponded to the weird details that we were seeing in the imagery that came in over CNN live, starting with this very interesting object. So, now let me go back to this particular picture. When I saw this shot, and I need to widen out here, all right? When I saw this shot, one of the things that struck me was that it was lying just off the panel of the rover. That's the top of the rover sitting on the solar panel of the lander. So it's literally inches away. And what you need to do is to look very carefully at the details of the solar panel, which is what we do up here, all right? And what you notice right away is that the geometry, the wonderful rectilinear geometry of the little silicon wafer solar cells, and the grid work and the wireframe support of the pop-up antenna that the UHF antenna that the rover was going to eventually use to communicate back to the lander, all of this is replicated with absolutely no distortion. But right off the panel, there is this remarkable thing which looks for all the world like a generator or a motor or some kind of regular shaft with, you know, an armature with field coils, with a casing. It's toroidal. It certainly is not a rock. And why is it not a rock? Well, this is where Ron Nix comes in. Because Ron's geology starts out by looking at the processes that erode landforms. And in technical language, it has too much orthogonal geometry in one tiny volume to possibly be the result of an erosive process. Orthogonal geometry means at right angles. Erosion takes place along trends, along one direction. Water flows in one direction. Wind abrasion is in one direction. To get sharp right angle geometry that is highly reticulated, meaning very detailed, in a tiny volume, and is symmetrical. Notice that this thing is nicely symmetrical. If you found it in the desert here on Earth, you'd say, oh my God, it's an old, you know, generator from a 47 Buick. But it's on Mars. So, of course, we got very intrigued. Now, let me show you what happens, all right? This is now a close-up of the same thing. All right, this is an enlargement. And you can see very clearly this remarkable internal geometry. And I put this on here to give people who need a kind of a model, because a lot of times when you're used to looking at things in two dimensions, you can't relate to a three-dimensional object. All right. The next stage in the analysis was to go back to the website and to see what NASA had done with this same data. Well, in the next iteration, right following the live frame that came in, all right, from CNN, which we had compared carefully with the...